Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is September 3rd, 2020, 60 days to go. Joe Biden is headed to Kenosha, which is kind of a rare thing for Democrats to come to Wisconsin. Trump is threatening to cut off funds for anarchist jurisdictions, by which he appears to mean cities run by Democrats. He sounds like he's encouraging his supporters to engage in voter fraud or at least try to vote twice. And Facebook says that it's going to block political ads the week before the election. 881,000 more Americans filed jobless claims today. Yesterday, 1,075 more Americans died of the coronavirus. And you will be made to care about Nancy Pelosi and her hairstylist, right, A.B. Stoddard? A.B. Stoddard joins us again, associate editor, columnist for Real Clear Politics. Good morning. How are you?
I am well. Good to be with you, Charlie. How are you?
Good. Do you want to talk about the hairstylist, or should we talk about, I don't know, Russia, the coronavirus, the economy?
All of the numerous crises simultaneously crashing all over us, certainly trending on Facebook as one of the most important, is the setup that Nancy Pelosi claims happened when she was revealed to be maskless in a hair salon that wasn't supposed to be operating in San Francisco. I can barely get over it. I don't know what else to tell you.
Well, it's probably she should not have done it. It was a bad choice. But for people who think we're being snarky about this, I mean, this story is by far the biggest story on Facebook right now. Yeah. If you have a Facebook friend, they're talking about this. So of the top 25 performing link posts on U.S. Facebook in the last 24 hours, 13 of them are about Nancy Pelosi and her haircut. That's 13 out of 25. Four of the top five link posts on Facebook are about Nancy Pelosi's hairstyle. So when historians look back on this, they go, "Why? What were you Americans thinking? You had nearly 200,000 Americans dying of the coronavirus. You have massive economic dislocation. You have social disruption. The president of the United States is stoking racial division. And what were you people talking about?" The answer is Nancy Pelosi's haircut.
So. Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I think that she needs to be called out for not wearing a mask and fiddling with, you know, the rules on what should be open and not open. I know how wealthy she is. So I'm actually surprised she was even in a salon, because I would think that she would have a team of people lined up, even subs, to come do her hair in her bedroom. But I do think that she should be called out for, you know, any kind of violation of the rules and any hypocrisy, because I always believe that all politicians should. But you're right. I mean, when you say historians will look back at this, they'll say, no wonder you couldn't solve problems. I mean, this is, it's just, you know, our eyes are always on the insanity and the inanity and not on the real questions, which is right now, you know, there are so many, beyond the infected and the grieving and the dead, there are so many people right now absolutely agonizing with massive bankruptcies, foreclosures, and evictions. And, you know, the president will tweet about Chris Cuomo's TV ratings anyway.
Yeah, at least we're keeping our eyes on the prize. I haven't been able to check this morning whether or not we've had a Trumpian tweet storm about the Fox News poll. Actually, we had a whole bunch of polls yesterday. It was kind of Trumpapalooza, wasn't it? I think probably the biggest polling day that we've had in the year, at least so far. But the one that I'm sure that the president has seen is the Fox News poll showing him down 4 points in North Carolina, down 8 points in Wisconsin, down 9 points in Arizona. So, again, we could walk through all the different polls. I mean, I'm looking at this. You have Quinnipiac, 10-point Biden lead nationally. USA Today, Suffolk poll, a 7-point Biden lead. Reuters, a 7-point Biden lead. Grinnell, 8-point Biden lead. The Economist, YouGov, an 11-point Biden lead. These Fox News polls showing leading in three swing states. CNN had a poll last night showing an 8-point Biden lead. And then you have the USC Dorn's Life Daybreak, which is that like LA Times? I don't know. 11-point Biden lead. So give me your sense, A.B. Stoddard, where we're at in this race. I know that people are screaming at us right now going, national polls don't matter. They don't matter. All that matters is the Electoral College. But you kind of are getting a pretty solid picture, aren't we, of where the race stands right now?
Right. I think with the I'm very anti-national polls, so I'll join the chorus that, you know, warns that if you pay attention to national polls, you will be bewildered on election night, or, you know, whenever the ballots are counted in 2020. I do think that what the national polls tell us is that the structure of the race is quite dug in, and that the people that the DNC and the RNC were trying to speak to, those voting coalitions haven't shifted much, and that, you know, shifting on messaging and all the nice appeals from good, credible validators and surrogates for Trump to try to, you know, bring back college-educated white women or suburban voters is not likely to have been effective. And so that's really what that says for the rest of the race. And then which also has an impact on state polling is, how many things can he do now to shift the winds, the headwinds against him? And I argued in a piece last week that, you know, the traditional metrics by which we measure campaigns aren't, they kind of went out the window in 2016 anyway. Clinton had all of the structure lined up for a win: endorsements from influential people, more fundraisers, more offices in battleground states, more money, more mathematicians on her data team, everything you could, but he had the message. And he didn't retail politic, and he broke every rule, and he won anyway, obviously within an stride straight. But I don't even know that, you know, the debates this year are definitely going to shift votes either. It's such a jump ball. But the conventions were a big chance for the Republicans. I think the convention was really good, with the exception of his speech. And so that polling is bad news for them.
Yeah, there's no bump. A couple of interesting things about these numbers, though, because I keep looking for some evidence. How is the law and order pitch going? Is it actually moving votes? Because you can tell that they are all in on that. Of course, the president was in Kenosha. Joe Biden's going to be there later today. But here's something from the CNN poll. The pollster asked voters who they thought would keep America safe from harm. And the result was Biden 51, Trump 45. So on the question of safety, he's down six points. Here's another one. They asked which candidate would unite the country and not divide it. Biden 56, Trump 36. That is a 20-point gap. And then also in these swing states, in Arizona and Wisconsin, voters say that the ones we're polled say that they prefer Biden over Trump to handle the issues of policing and criminal justice by a 5-point margin. North Carolina kind of more basically split. But what is your sense, though? You can tell that the campaign has gone. I mean, you know, this is all you're going to read about in Trump World Facebook, Trump World Twitter. You know, this is the message from the conservative media. The campaign keeps talking about the burning cities. And we're looking at, you know, our suburban housewives. Are they being freaked out about this? Is the message taking that you need to vote for Trump? Otherwise, you're going to have torch bearing mobs led by Cory Booker coming to your street soon?
Yes, Cory Booker is going to work in the Biden administration and as a secretary of HUD, and he's going to bring black and brown people to your neighborhood, and then it's going to burn down. I mean, it has not been a subtle message from the president. And Cory Booker has he's appeared several times in several of these messages. It's quite astonishing. But I think that the polls that you just read off about harm versus public safety and criminal justice, you know, criminal justice, probably that kind of phrasing of that kind of polling question would help Biden. Public safety, harm, you know, this is, if this was 1968, if this was another year where there was not a pandemic and an economic depression moving into a recession and not a recovery, you could really amplify this message. The problem is that we all have kids at home trying to learn online. In the other room, I have two college students that just got there as freshmen 10 days ago that are hoping not to be in a swarm of an outbreak. They're on their beds doing Zooms in dorm rooms without AC. I think about Kenosha, but if you just think about how many families, I am not about to be evicted. I am a blessed person with plenty to be thankful for, but just the average family with school children right now is consumed by the fact that we can't come back to normal. We're reminded of it every hour of every day, that we don't have testing to screen populations to safely go back to school. The schools might not stay open, the ones that are open. What will online learning do? So this idea of this Law and Order message helping him out. A, you have to rely on Portland continuing, you know, to be violent, and Kenosha and other cities and all this rioting lasting. You have to hope that Joe Biden's sort of calming and uniting message about condemning violence and saying it's deserving of prosecution doesn't blunt your message, which is all offense and all division. And then you have to get people who are thinking about their economic hardship or their kids not being able to properly be in school to think about what's going on in the cities. Some, you know, most of them, they don't even live there. So it's really hard with these other all-consuming crises for his message to break through. And Biden's response has been so measured and so sane and so sensible, which is, I just want everyone to try to believe that we can have a solution, that I could bring the cops to the table, that, you know, that we have, that racism is wrong and police brutality is wrong, but so is rioting and looting and arson. And he's not matching Trump's, you know, kind of partisan, extreme and divisive rhetoric. He kind of neutralizes it. And yeah, it's so interesting to see these polls now, and I'll be interested to see what they look like in 3 weeks.
Let me bounce two things off you. I had two thoughts this morning. One is that, and none of these are particularly original, but the first is that Donald Trump still hasn't gotten over not running against Bernie Sanders. All of his literature is aimed at, I mean, you go on, right, on you know, Trumpian media, and it's all about, you know, Antifa and the socialists and the radical left. And it's like, guys, it's Joe Biden. You're running against Joe Biden, and they're having a hard time with that. The second thought is that Trump, in some ways, I think, is trapped by his base. This is his strength, right? That he has this immovable base that he can say anything to and he can feed any red meat to. But because he's so focused on the language and the memes and the narratives and the emotion of his base, he's having a really hard time talking to other Americans. So I don't know whether you saw the piece of literature that I got here at my house in Wisconsin. I tweeted it out saying, a Muslim, a Jew, and an Hispanic woman walk into a bar. What do you have? You have the piece of literature that I got from the Wisconsin Republican Party, and it's a picture of Ilhan Omar, Bernie Sanders, AOC, and then in the middle there is Joe Biden. Okay, so these are the three people, and then the headline is, it looks kind of like a cartoon. The radical left has taken over Joe Biden. Don't let them take over America. And my first reaction was, I kind of rolled my eyes as, yeah, this is their pitch in suburban Wisconsin. But apparently when I tweeted it out, it's not just Wisconsin. People are getting this in Michigan, in Minnesota, in Pennsylvania. Some of my colleagues at the Bulwark got it in Virginia. They are going all in. This is right now their message. They're pumping all of this direct mail. The radical left has taken over Joe Biden. So again, you got the Ilhan Omar, Bernie Sanders, AOC. And it's like, yeah, guys, they're not on the ballot. They're the ones who didn't win the Democratic primary. It's Joe Biden. Maybe this is why this campaign just feels a little bit off sync, because he's running against the other guys. And I got to say, when I'm looking at this literature, I'm thinking, you know what? This is what they think is, you know, is this the appeal now to scare the suburbanites? Because it really underestimates, I think, the sophistication of voters, that they're going to look at this and go, oh yeah, right, you know, what kind of crap is this? So did you get this at all, AB? Do you get literature like this at home? Are you on that list?
For one, I can't believe I missed it, because I'm always on Twitter. But when I find out that I've missed something on Twitter, it makes me feel better that maybe I was off of it for a few hours. So I have not actually seen it, but I have marveled at their efforts to try to make Joe Biden into AOC. I saw their sort of desperate excitement after Senator Markey held his seat in the primary against Joe Kennedy, because he has, you know, the endorsement of AOC. So basically that's a sign, right, that she's taking over. The moment for this to happen, for the Republicans to rub their hands together and relish the handover, was the convention. And the Democratic Party put on the most cautious convention, all aimed towards persuadable voters, maybe not Obama to Trump voters, but former Republican, center-right, independent, to say Joe Biden is the same Joe Biden you've always known, and he works with Republicans. He believes that we can come together to solve problems, and he is not a product of the radical progressive left, and he is not going to let them in the 4 years that he's president, which is, you know, the implied, implicit one term we all expect him to serve. And the entire convention was about that. Not once did you see him stooping to the wokester to try to convince and mobilize. It was all about persuasion. Joe Biden is not scary. And so I think they're just going to keep going back to it. As you said, they were sort of on, you know, that was the channel that they put in their engine on, a great economy and Bernie Sanders as a socialist. And they can't seem to get back onto America's consumed with a once in 100-year deadly emergency pandemic and economic downturn. And they're looking at Trump versus a moderate. I don't think they can address
well, that. And these are easily countered by Biden. He just does the shrug of the shoulders and says, you know, do I look like a dangerous radical? And now they've come up with a new nickname, Hayden Biden, which is like all he has to do is show up. And it's like, okay, you've blown up that talking point. Okay, you mentioned something. I just have to comment on this. It's really not to our subject, but leaving aside the whole politics, the progressive versus the mainstream, whatever, in Massachusetts Democratic politics, I have to say that my visceral reaction to Senator Markey beating Joe Kennedy, the 98th, was good. I have this thing about dynasties, and particularly, you know, self-important entitled dynasties like the Kennedys. Okay, you can rip me, I want us to be over that. Yeah. You know, I want to be past that. I don't want any more Clintons. I don't want any more Bushes. I don't want any more Kennedys. I want to actually go back to the system where we actually, you know, didn't have, you know, a hereditary system of government in this country. Okay, so let's talk about Russia for a minute. You have a piece up in the Bulwark, a really comprehensive piece about it's still Russia. We're back to Russia. There was no Russia hoax. So let's talk about this. There have been a couple of developments that people have seen. Facebook takes down some sites of people who were pushing Russian disinformation. We have the director of national intelligence who says, yeah, I don't need to actually brief Congress anymore about possible Russian interference. The Department of Homeland Security suppresses apparently a memo warning the country that the Russians might try to plant disinformation, raising questions about Joe Biden's mental acuity, which I don't know why the Russians need to do that, since that's the president, what the president is doing. And you raise something that need to take a deep breath, because this gets me kind of worked up here. We're talking about Nancy Pelosi at the hairstylist and all of this stuff. Pardon my language here, but what the fuck happened to the story about the Russians paying a bounty to kill American soldiers in Afghanistan?
I mean, this is, I have a long list. I mean, it was long for you to read those developments, but it goes on and on, which is the Senate Intelligence Report that laid bare the most unbelievable betrayal, the conduct by the Trump campaign, let alone the president, who clearly has very, very well likely lied in his written responses to the special counsel about his conversations with Roger Stone about the WikiLeaks attack. And there's all these national security developments, provocations by the Russians, which are pretty much going unanswered. And Senator, in the piece, I note that Senator Tammy Duckworth keeps a account on Twitter, and I believed it, today's day 69, of his silence on the Russian bounty story. It's the most stunning betrayal of the men and women in uniform who risk their lives for us. There are Gold Star families in this country who need to know if they lost a loved one to a bounty paid to the Taliban from the Russians. There's just the most astonishing things happening along the line of this Russia and Trump working together to help him get reelected, that just is drowned out by all this other news and the fact that he's managed just to change the narrative. And it is just an astonishing collection of facts that, you know, lead us to this place that whether people care or not, the last 4 years have been a huge gift to Putin. He has been so strengthened by this presidency. He is so overtly working to defeat Joe Biden and help Trump get reelected. Trump is welcoming it. And it's, it's just, I think, one of the worst things that's ever happened to this country.
You know, and you make the point that even if he doesn't succeed in electing the country, I mean, in electing the president, reelecting the president, he really has cashed in mightily. Yeah. You know, I've talked about this before. The return on investment for what Vladimir Putin has done is stunning. It really is just amazing.
It's from the Ukraine to Syria, from Iraq to Afghanistan. It's just, and obviously what he's done to us, a weakened NATO, a weakened EU, and a weakened United States of America, both internally and domestically and internationally, which is unrecognizable from 4 years ago. And it's, sure, we had problems with our alliances before. Sure, we had, you know, problems with globalism and you know, isolationism and these, you know, political winds within our electorate before Trump and all these strains. But Putin's ability now to continue to strengthen his posture across the Middle East and really, you know, with the major players, the Chinese, the Iranians, I mean, it's just unparalleled to what it was 4 years ago, because we've been denigrated and because those other coalitions and alliances have been and institutions have been denigrated.
So how fixable is this?
Oh.
You know, if he leaves on January 20th and Joe Biden comes into the presidency, can this damage be repaired? Can America reassume? Can they just, you know, come back and reassume its position of world leadership, talking about American exceptionalism, that we're the shining city on the hill, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I mean, it's going to be very hard. I think, you know, you would see Joe Biden, I think he... is very worried about China. And I think he would probably get back into some kind of renegotiation of TPP so that we could have a multilateral front against the Chinese that, you know, we're sorely lacking. And, you know, then you talk about the strength of our partnerships. You know, sure, the Germans still, you know, want us to reassert ourselves, you know, the French, the British. But things have changed. And the Chinese economy is, you know, really in a better position. It's going to be very hard. I don't know. I'm not an expert in these matters. Obviously, it's not like something you can undo overnight. And then you have to bring along, the faith of the American people about this. You know, that it's important. And Trump has drowned out the voices in the Republican Party who used to defend this and to be champions of our role in the world. And so now you just have left, you know, Mitt Romney somewhere sounding like he's running in 2012, talking about how we're the hope of the earth, and people like, you know, Marco Rubio, who used to insist that without our leadership, everything would crumble, is in a basement somewhere with a gag in his mouth.
I'm going to come back to that in a moment, because, of course, we've been talking about this for the last 4 years about the incredible acquiescence, which is still breathtaking. So in answer to that question of how easily fixable it is, I mean, the damage is deep. It's going to be long lasting, but it can be fixed if you start next year. 8 years of Donald Trump, that's when I think you have the rest of the world making other arrangements, right? They basically have to decide, okay, we're not going to be looking to the United States. Let's come up with different structures, different attitudes, different protocols, everything. 8 years, I think, becomes much, much less fixable. Then that's really the end of an American position in the world. And as you point out, in the absence of any, you know, counter pressure from the people who know better, we're not going to get it. Okay, can I raise an issue that nobody cares about?
Yes, I raise them all the time. I write about them. I take a lot of time expending energy on them.
Okay, well, I want to officially talk about something that I know bores absolutely everybody in the entire universe except me. So yesterday we got this new report that the budget deficit is going to reach $3.3 trillion this year. Okay, in fiscal year 2020. And it will total $13 trillion over the next decade. The deficit is going to be $1.6 trillion, which is more than 5% of the entire GDP in 2030 alone. Okay, I understand that people's eyes are rolling back in their heads and glazing over, but this means that the U.S. debt will eclipse the size of the entire U.S. economy next year, growing from 79% of GDP in 2019 to 104% of GDP in 2021. Debt it will surpass the all-time record, reaching 170% of the GDP by 2023 and 109% by 2030. Okay, a lot of numbers, too big, people don't care. But AB, I'm sorry, I am old enough to remember when the Republican Party would have absolutely freaked out over numbers like that.
This is one of the themes of the last kind of 6 months that has been so discouraging, is just sort of figuring out what Americans and the voting electorate don't care about. Because what I've noticed through the primary campaign, Biden winning the nomination and Biden wading into the general election, is that he has figured out, though he talks about democracy a lot, that people are not really invested in that message. And they're not as, so they do not believe Trump is a threat to democracy the way we do, the way Joe Biden does. That Russia is no big deal. That if we are a quasi-satellite of the Russian Federation, oh well. And the final thing is the debt is also, I mean, there's no party representing any kind of concern and goal to get our government back on course. And it's so beyond alarming. I find
that alarming. Yeah, but you're going to know they're going to get that old time religion back in January,
yeah,
right?
The Republicans will. It'll be led by Mick Mulvaney and Gordon. But I also, the other thing is the criminality of the Trump administration. That I've come to the conclusion, lo, these months in lockdown or whatever we're in, that if Joe Biden spent money on ads in swing states to outline, forget the emoluments violations and all the self-dealing and all of the corporations who need a merger, renting out empty hotel rooms at the Trump resorts to curry favor with him, and all of the crooked and criminal and corrupt cabinet members. And you just looked at the fact that the president has been credibly accused of obstruction of justice, incredibly accused of rape. He is an unindicted co-conspirator in a felony crime his lawyer served time in jail for, and he's under criminal investigation by the state of New York. Biden would be wasting his ad money. Because people don't care.
Really? Do you think they don't care, though? I was actually thinking about that there are a lot of people who actually do seem to believe that he, you know, he came to Washington to drain the swamp. And if you went right at the fat cat corruption, the insider dealing, you know, Steve Bannon on the yacht with the Chinese billionaire, the postmaster general with all of his conflicts of interest. The one thing that the Trump voters might respond to is like, okay, is this what you voted for? These bailouts of these big corporations, the self-dealing, all of that stuff. You know, maybe leave out some of the other more technical corruption. But I mean, this has not just been the swamp. This has been an administration that has repopulated the swamp with lizard people. And I gotta think that might play with some of these voters here in Wisconsin and Michigan.
See,
and Minnesota.
I'm so animated by that stuff that I am trying to make the ad already with you. But I just don't. I think that all the focus groups and all the research, has been invested, you know, in time and money since 2016 to just figure out what these people are thinking about all of Trump's liabilities and which ones resonate with them. And it's true. I mean, a well done ad, his cabinet alone is like something out of a comedy film. You know, I mean, it's just a complete and utter joke. But him and his family, it's just and serious, serious legal liability on so many different fronts. But again, I think that if voters really cared, we would see more attention to that messaging.
Yeah, I think so. What about the whole question of Social Security? I guess I was going to ask the question, what would work? I do think that, you know, Democrats have been running for, you know, decades saying that Republicans are endangering Social Security. But right now you literally have the president of the United States ordering all of the funding mechanisms for Social Security to be suspended until the end of the year. That would seem to be the kind of issue that would, okay, you know, very tangible. This is what he has actually done. I'm not telling you what he might do in the future. This is a guy that basically has taken a Social Security trust fund that has been very vulnerable, and he has cut off all of the inflow of money to it. That's a problem. There's already been erosion among senior citizens support for Trump, that would seem to be a silver bullet.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be the thing that the Democrats ought to pound
away.
Joe Biden
did talk about that the other day in his remarks, and I thought that was pretty shrewd. I do think that priorities and some of these PACs that have been working for a long time on healthcare messaging throughout 2017 and into the midterms, and then as a result of the success in the midterms with a healthcare message, are very much quietly on the ground beating the drum on the Trump effort to undermine Social Security and to destroy the ACA and destabilize the entire system. And the fact that he actually doesn't, what we learned from this convention is he supports people who have pre-existing conditions, but he doesn't actually protect them.
No. And by the way, 2018 was all about healthcare, in part because of that particular issue involving pre-existing conditions. I'm kind of wondering, you know, when that becomes a big issue again, because they're very vulnerable. Let me ask you another question, though. Today, the former Republican governor of Michigan, Rick Snyder, endorsed Joe Biden. I mean, this is not just some slouch. This is a very, very well-known Republican official. You know, he joins a growing list of Republicans who've been willing to break ranks with Trump and endorse Biden. Really unprecedented. I don't remember when this has ever happened at this level or this scope. Does that make a difference, AB? Do these endorsements actually make a difference?
I do think that cumulatively, I mean, I think that when it's someone that's predictable, like John Kasich, you go, oh, well, you know, he wasn't supporting him in 2016, so who cares? But when it's a surprise like Rick Snyder and all of the steady drumbeat from the RVAT ads, voters who, you know, at risk in their communities and families have come out and made these incredibly compelling videos about why they can't support Donald Trump. And just, you know, the sort of wave of people that are coming out to do these group endorsements for, you know, faith leaders, Nobel laureates, you know, former military, you know, all these people coming out for Biden. If it's, you know, it's not like if George Bush gave him an endorsement. I know he's not going to, but if he did in October, that wouldn't really do it. I think it's the mass of names coming at you that, and what it does is it doesn't convince a diehard Trump supporter, but it shames the Trump triers and the Trump tolerators. And it says, look at these people who have said enough is enough. Why aren't you saying that too? And I think that Republicans for Integrity is doing that. And it's, I think that effort to shame their friends and peers is that's tough to take for those people. And it doesn't mean
they're all. No, I think it also, again, we've used the phrase permission structure before, that it gives a permission, creates a permission structure for people to do that, because it is a very, very heavy lift. Now, people need to understand this. It is a very heavy lift for people who have voted Republican their whole life to actually vote for a Democrat. And it feels very, and you know, over the last few years, it's felt very lonely. It has felt like you are kind of a freak and an outlier. Why haven't you gotten on board? So when you have names like this coming forward, I think it does on the margins make a difference. And of course, this election might be decided on the margins. Okay, one more thing, going just looping back to when we're talking about the polls, you know, all of these national polls that show a pretty stable, pretty sizable Trump lead, which doesn't matter because this is going to be decided by who gets to 270 electoral votes. Nate Silver had a very interesting analysis going to the point of what kind of a national lead does Biden have to win the Electoral College. And let me just walk this through. I don't know if you've seen this. So if he's leading the national polls by 0 to 1 point, he has just a 6% chance of winning the Electoral College. If he's leading by 1 to 2 points, he has only a 22% chance of winning the Electoral College. If Joe Biden goes into Election Day leading by 2 to 3 points, he then has a 46% chance of winning the Electoral College. So we're looking at a 3-point lead in the polls, and it's more likely than not that Biden would lose. Then you get to 3 or 4 points, and this is why these numbers matter so much. If Joe Biden is winning by 3 to 4 points, then that jumps up to 74% chance. If he's leading by 4 to 5 points, he has an 89% chance to win the Electoral College, leading by 5 to 6 points, 98% chance. If he's leading by 6 to 7 points nationally, Nate Silver, again, this is his model, his projection, then he would have a 99% chance. So basically, when you hear people say, the experts, the pundits, the Steve Kornackis of the world, you know, talking about, you know, the Biden has to win that popular vote by 3 points or more, this is what they're talking about. So that's what to watch for. Right now, the real clear politics average is what? It's between seven and eight points. Yeah, it's 7.2, which I think is actually a little bit low because they throw in, you know, with all apologies to the Real Clear average folks, they throw in some sketchy polls. But let's say that it's 7 or 8 points. That's a pretty solid position, even in terms of the Electoral College. If that race tightens down to 3 or 4, it is going to be a freaking white knuckle experience.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting because Charlie, you and I have talked about it many times, sort of the nightmare of election night and what Trump says. And, you know, the whole thing is just so, so frightening. It's not even worth repeating. But it's really, to quote Tim Russert, it's really all about Florida. So unfortunately for Joe Biden, his national leads are great. It seems pretty robust. His battle state polling is good. It looks like he's going to flip Arizona. He's making Republicans mm-hmm. spend money in Ohio and in Iowa and in Georgia and North Carolina and Texas. That's a lot of money. You know, they're playing a lot of defense. I read the other day that 97% of the senatorial money is being spent by Republicans on defense, and same number by and 97% by Democrats on offense. It is interesting, but when I look at the map, I just think that when I ask around to the map masters, the types of people that you just talked about, they say the only hope, and actually Steve Kornacki said this on your podcast, the only hope to finish up on election night with a result is Florida. And so you have to think, Steve Shales, a Florida strategist, and he was quoted in the New York Times yesterday saying that Biden's in better shape in Florida than Obama was in 8 or 12. I just think that they need to spend a lot of money in Florida because, you know, you can't count on this national lead comfort, right? And you want to know that you have a real chance to just put a nail in the coffin on election.
Well, and also to underline your point, though, another important point about Florida, they count their votes relatively quickly, right. Don't they? So that's one we're not, unlike say California, we're not going to have to wait weeks to find out. So election night, we will get a really good idea. And if Biden wins in Florida, you pretty much know where it's going to go. If Trump wins again in Florida, it's going to be much more of a slog. Now, I think that's fair. And so we're going to get that early mood set on election night, but it's not going to be decided on election night.
I don't think so. Unless Biden somehow amasses a decisive lead in Florida, like a win, you know, and of course, we know that President Trump believes that all the vote counts and the absentee votes in Florida are legit. So of course they'll go along with it.
Okay. Now, have I asked you about Bill Barr yet? Okay, Bill Barr said a lot of things yesterday, and I tweeted out. I was not aware that there was a contest for like the worst human being in the world. I mean, maybe he's going for the gold medal, but I, you know, considering that we are still in the midst of this debate, this you know, reevaluation of police and, you know, shooting young black men, and we have another case in Rochester, New York, of a case where a man was suffocated. But this is what the Attorney General of the United States had to say last night.
You know, I think the narrative that that the police are on some epidemic of shooting unarmed black men is simply a false narrative, and also the narrative that's based on race. The fact of the matter is, it's very rare for an unarmed African American to be shot by a white police officer.
And he also goes on to talk about the case from Kenosha, where Jacob Blake was shot 7 times in the back, saying that he was armed at the time. And Wolf Blitzer has to correct him and say, no, he actually wasn't. The knife was in the car. And Barr sort of just blows past that. Well, that's what I believe. You know, on one level, why is the Attorney General opining about this stuff in the midst of an investigation? But your thoughts, A.B. Stoddard.
I found that interview to be astonishing. Number one, Bill Barr gives a lot of interviews on topics he should not be weighing in on and gets very political. But the tone that he took and the things that he said, that there is not excessive police, excessive use of force by white police officers against unarmed Black men, when we've seen video after video after video with our own eyes. But he refuses to acknowledge the studies that show there is no significant evidence by any study of mail-in voter fraud, because he's going to use his logic, like the president uses his gut, to make an argument he wants to make and refute the facts and admit he has no evidence. So there's no problem with excessive force among white officers dealing with unarmed Black men. And then there is this huge raging crisis in the making. He says, people are playing with fire. They're playing with fire about mail-in voting. Did he offer to fix it? Did he want to assure people after we have had no testing regimen, no tracing regimen, no way to control the spread of the virus? He's basically telling us now that we have no way to safely vote. I mean, it was preposterous on so many levels. And I couldn't believe that he could do it with a straight face.
No, you're right. And I just think that the fact that they are all in on this issue at this particular point, it's going to be interesting to see how Joe Biden handles himself in Kenosha. I think that, you know, if shamelessness is Donald Trump's superpower, then empathy is Joe Biden's. And I think that's going to be on display as well. A.B. Stoddard, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast again today. I appreciate
Always
it very
great to
much.
Be with you, Charlie. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again. There are just 60 days to go until the election.